Thank you very much. I'm a geologist by background, but got drawn into coastal management at a fairly early stage. And we are fortunate enough to be able to work on coastlines all over the world. So what I want to talk about is something that's quite widespread, quite topical at the present time, and that is what we do about changing coastlines, in particular the changes that are being brought about by climate change. To some extent, the climate change aspect is almost a red herring, because the bigger picture is how we live with coasts that change, no matter what produces the change. Most of our activities demand static, fixed boundaries, and we find it difficult to do what we do when the environment around us is changing. But we know that coastlines change. We see change on every beach. That's the beauty of beaches and, in fact, of the whole coastal zone. They're capable of taking anything that the ocean throws at them, changing their shape, absorbing that energy, and most of the time readjusting to the new set of circumstances. So they're wonderfully adaptable natural environments. They do change in response to waves, tides and currents, to the boundaries within which they exist, the rocky headlands here, and the sea level on the other side. So if we change any of those, we're likely to change the shape of the coastline. The other issue is that sometimes those changes are progressive and gradual, and we barely see them over decades or even centuries. Other times they're episodic, so we see them very rapidly, and I'll show some examples of that. So of course the big issue of the moment is global climate change and the link between CO2 in the atmosphere and global temperatures. There is a strong set of evidence suggesting that we're into uncharted territories in terms of global temperatures. They haven't had temperatures at the levels that we do have now for several hundred thousand years. This is showing us the temperatures for the last 1,000 years or so, and you can see that we're up into a fairly high position. And of course, from the coastline perspective, the fact that sea level is closely tied to temperature is the thing that concerns us most, because as the Earth's temperature warms, the ocean waters expand, more water comes in from melting ice into the oceans, and consequently the sea levels rise. We know from tide gauge records that global sea levels have been rising, certainly over the last century and a half. This is a plot of average global mean sea levels from tide gauges since 1880. And the average rate of sea level rise over that entire period is a little short of 2 millimeters per year. Doesn't seem very much compared to the size of the average wave on the west coast here, which is something like 1.5 meters. But it's an appreciable amount whenever it's progressive over a long period of time. And what's of concern at the moment is that there seems to be an acceleration. So if you look at the early part of that curve, the rate of sea level rise is only about 1 millimeter per year. In the central part, it goes up to 2 millimeters per year. In the most recent part, we're up to over 3 millimeters per year. So there's a suggestion that there's an acceleration in the rate at which sea levels are rising. And we now update that using satellite altimetry, which is able to tell us, without having to average lots of different tide gauge records, which are influenced by all sorts of terrestrial perturbations, what is happening to the global average sea level from space. And that's giving us a rate of 3.5 millimeters per year over this 13-year period. The $64,000 question, of course, is what's going to happen in the future? And there are many different projections about that. Looking at a range of projections from an extreme of almost 2 meters by 2100, down to a minimum amount of somewhere around 0.5 meter by 2100. So there's a very, very wide range. And that much of that variability is down to the rates at which ice caps melt and how quickly they break up and shed the ice into the ocean. That's where most of the questions are at the present time. Of course, as many people know, this is nothing new. This is sea level change over the last 20,000 years or so. Since the last ice age ended, sea levels have risen 120 metres, which makes our 2 millimetres per year seem a tiny amount. And there have been periods during that time when sea level has risen at very fast rates. During this meltwater pulse, sea level rose something like 30 metres in the space of 300 years. We were measuring annual rates of sea level rise in the centimetres then, not in the millimetres level. And it seems now that the more scientists delve into this, the more pulses like that there have been. So it hasn't been a smoothly rising sea level, it's been a pulsed one. And perhaps what we're seeing now is something akin to a meltwater pulse, a rapid influx of seawater, a rapid influx of water from ice into the sea. Well, of course, the question about all of this is, what does it matter to us? So what if the Earth is warming, if the sea levels are rising, and so on? Well, coastlines respond to those. We're changing the boundary conditions at the coastline. And the main manifestation of rising sea level is in shoreline retreat and flooding. It's natural adjustment. If you raise the level of the water, the processes that take place on that water level are going to extend further landwards than they did before. And the consequence of that is that the shoreline will adjust, and it does so usually by retreating. I hesitate to use the word coastal erosion because that implies the loss of material, but a shoreline can retreat without necessarily losing material offshore. Sometimes it's pushed landwards, and we'll see some examples of that in a moment. But the bottom line is that the shoreline tends to move landwards, and alongside that, low-lying areas become flooded more frequently than they did in the past, again because the average water level's higher. So if we have a shoreline retreat and flooding in a tropical island like this one, where there's nothing except a hammock strung between the palm trees, it doesn't really matter. No one would know or care or even notice if the shoreline retreated and the area in behind it was flooded. The coastline can take care of itself. The beach can move landwards. Everything adjusts to that new set of circumstances. The same for a local beach, it's Kinnegow Bay in Donegal. There's no infrastructure there. There's no houses, roads. Barely anyone ever goes there. And if sea level were to rise at 1 metre, the beach will move landwards, up the hill a little bit. No one would notice. The beach would still be there, would look exactly as it does now. Now, on the other hand, if you live somewhere like that, then retreat and flooding are serious issues for you. They're serious issues because there are structures there, and the structures are going to be affected as the shoreline retreats and as flooding becomes more frequent. This is maybe a little bit more typical of a developed shoreline, a beach in Florida lined with high rise, quite a narrow beach in the front, low-lying areas in behind. And if we have shoreline retreat here, there's nowhere for the shoreline to go. It's very quickly going to find itself up against these high-rise buildings. So those are becoming a barrier to the adjustment of the coastline. The coastline wants to move landwards and move upwards, but finds buildings in the way. So there's a problem here, but the problem is not the beach's problem. It's the problem is posed by the buildings being in the way of where the beach needs to be. This is sort of the key to our issues about adapting to climate change. We have a situation, very often it's not a clean sheet. We have put things where they really oughtn't to be, and now we face the situation where the environment's changing, and what do we do about it? So that's the shoreline retreat, coastal erosion issue of rising sea levels and climate change. The other aspect is increased flooding. And this is an interesting graph put out by the Royal Irish Academy a few years ago. It shows the highest water level reached by the tide in Dublin Port since 1923. And right at the far side, you see the flood of February 2002. You can notice that it's the highest water recorded in Dublin Port since the foundation of the state. That's about the average high water level in Dublin Port, 2.3 metres, ordnance datum. And the one that we see in 2002 is about 50 centimetres higher than that. If you remember that I said the lowest estimate for sea level rise by 2100 is about 50 centimetres. That means that we would expect that type of flood, if we raised the sea level 50 centimetres, to be happening almost every year by 2100. At the moment, that's the flood of the century, the highest level that water level has reached. Now, on a natural coast, and the marshes, that doesn't matter. The tide comes in, the tide goes out again. It doesn't matter if it's 2 or 3 metres higher than normal. If you've got a surge, it comes in, deposits a layer of mud, and out it goes again. But when you have infrastructure there, the tide comes in, it floods that infrastructure, it causes widespread damage. So that flood in the Isle of Man in 2002 caused £4 million worth of damage in the space of 3 hours, just as the high tide overtopped the seawall and flooded down into the streets and buildings behind. In Ireland, it caused insurance losses of €37 million. That was just from one storm, the sort of storm of the century. But to emphasise the issue of climate change and sea level rise, that's based on our average high water level being this 2.3 metres. If we raise sea level by just this 50 centimetres, and you can see that that type of flood would be happening almost every year. So we'd be sustaining €35 million of insurance damage every year. The Isle of Man would be being flooded every year with its £4 million worth of damage. That wouldn't happen. We'd do something about that. And that's where our adaptation challenge lies, is what do we do about those things? The big message here is that climate change isn't a threat to coasts. As I said, all those undeveloped coastlines can take care of themselves perfectly well. It's the infrastructure and the development that's a threat to the coast. It's how we reconcile the infrastructure, property and development aspects with a changing coastline that's the big challenge for us in adaptation. We are in a position where we don't have to go with the flow. We can make plans in advance because to some extent, although we're uncertain about the magnitude of future sea level rise, we know that it is rising. We know it's going to rise faster in the next, by 2100, than it has in the past. And we have pretty good estimates of the lower and upper ends of where that probability might be. So we can make plans and we can forecast and estimate what the impacts of climate change and rising sea level might be for our coastlines. And if we take proactive steps, we can save ourselves a lot of money, save ourselves a lot of anguish and grief if we've done the things in anticipation of future changes, so we don't sustain the damage and then have to repair things afterwards. So here's where we come to the idea of adapting to coastal change. And I think there are two ways that we can do this. We can adapt human activities to suit that changing environment, which is at one end of a spectrum, if you like. Or we can adapt the environment in order to maintain human activities. So this one is saying we change what we do, recognising that the environment is changing. And this other one says we're going to carry on doing what we've always done right here, and we're going to put up whatever defences or barriers that we need in order to enable us to do that. And I think we should call this one adaptation and this one resistance, because this says we're going to carry on doing the same thing. So we're going to resist the change. And this other one, we're going to adapt to it. I like to use a boxing analogy for that. If you're in the ring with an equal opponent, you know, you might stay in there for a decent length of time if you're prepared to roll with the punches and you can manage to acquit yourself reasonably well. On the other hand, you might decide to just stand there and slug it out. And these are rather similar to the two options that we have. The rolling with the punches idea is us adapting. The slugging it out is the resistance aspect. And of course, if the other guy's better than you, that's where resistance takes you. And of course, nature is the big guy whenever we're relating to the coastline. It's shown very nicely in the regular pictures we see of North Atlantic hurricanes, whether it be Katrina, Irene, Superstorm Sandy. Those are big, big hitters. And we can't stop them. We can't do anything about the impacts that those guys deliver to us. Just by way of illustration, here is the Outer Banks of North Carolina right after Hurricane Irene. The road, which used to run through there, has been completely broken. There's a new tidal inlet. This row of houses on the left that extends out into the sea used to go further into the sea, but those houses have long since gone. And I'm told that before this photograph, several years before this photograph, there were two more rows of houses seaward of that. So we can't hold the shoreline in place. We have to take those hits in such places. The decision is then, what do you do about it? Do you decide to rebuild and accept that these things will continue to happen? Or do you say, we've had enough, let's move out of here and give the coast space to adjust itself? These are two consecutive photographs of the same location in New Jersey, before and after Hurricane Sandy. The sea's off to the right. You can just see the beach there. Here's a nice row of houses. I'm told each one of those is worth about $1 million. It's a very desirable place to be. This is the sort of New York Riviera. And when Superstorm Sandy came along, that's what happened. This is the way the coast adjusts in a place like this. If there were no houses here, it would do exactly the same. Sand is taken from the seaward edge deposited on the top of the barrier island. That means the barrier island is raised up, and as a result, when the next storm comes along, it's more able to cope with subsequent storms. We sometimes call this rollover, barrier rollover, and it's one of those circumstances where while the shoreline retreats, the sediment isn't lost, it just rolls landward as if you were rolling up a carpet. The trouble, of course, here is that the houses get buried underneath that sand that's being carried landward. And we don't need to go all the way across the Atlantic to see the effect of storms. This is last winter's efforts at La Hinche. Of course, we shouldn't be surprised at this. The North Atlantic is an energetic environment, and when we put structures next to something that's capable of throwing 100-ton blocks around, we should expect to sustain damage. We shouldn't be shocked and appalled whenever, you know, a few small blocks like this get torn off a wall or pieces get thrown over the top of the wall. These are small potatoes compared to what the waves are capable of throwing about. And yet we do get shocked whenever damage is sustained at the coast. This is the seawall in Cushion Dawl last winter. Collapsed, there was a whole hue and cry in the press. But when I first went to Coleraine in the early 90s, it had just collapsed then as well during an earlier storm. Yeah, it got rebuilt, but of course the waves were able to take it away again whenever a storm came along. The adjacent beaches didn't have this kind of damage. The beaches could change their shape, become lower during the storms, store the sand offshore, and when the storms pass, the sand comes back on shore. The natural system's able to adjust, the infrastructure's not able to adjust. Very good pictures on the BBC. I don't know if you had them here at Christmas time, of the dramatic pictures of people being rescued from a bus in Wales. It looked all very dramatic and as if there must have been a really devastating storm. But whenever you look on Google Earth to see where that road is, it's less surprising. It's right on the back of the beach. So, you know, little wonder that a bus going along there during the storm of the decade happened to get washed off the road. The railway in Devon was washed away, undermined. The problem, of course, being that it was built on top of the beach, and that's where the waves wanted to expend their energy. They needed to take sand from what used to be the dune. It wasn't there anymore. They hit the railway line and washed it away. And Aberystwyth came in for a very good amount of coverage on the news. This used to be the road. Here's a little grassy area in front, and that's the beach. The whole thing's covered with shingle from the beach. It was very dramatic. The shingle was going through the windows of these houses in behind. But there was nothing new. It had happened in 1938. It happened also in 1927. Almost exactly the same kind of pictures. When you delve back into the archives, it again becomes clear why this is the case. This is the promenade being built, and you can see it's being built on the beach. So little wonder that it got damaged and got covered in beach sand whenever a storm came along. It wasn't active for a long period of time, but the waves needed that sand that was now under the promenade in order to cope with the energy being thrown at it by those storms. It takes us back to our dilemma. You know, we can adapt our human activities to suit that environment, or we can try and adapt the environment to maintain these things that we've always done. And unfortunately, we find this much easier to do. You only have to take a look around any part of the Irish coast, in fact, any part of the world's coast, and you'll see that this is what we're doing all over the place. We're not rolling with the punches, we're trying to slug it out with nature. I'll just show a few examples from Ulster. Everywhere you go, you'll find this kind of structure at the back of the beach. Here's some to protect a road. Here's another bunch of armour protecting a small road. Another type of armour protecting a stretch of road. Massive armour here near Mullyle. This is not going to move under any circumstances. But even in front of individual houses, you find rock armour in place. Everywhere there's a house, there's armour in front. People feel they must protect their property. This guy's built a nice wall to protect his house. Unfortunately, the beach level has dropped, and eventually that beach will get squeezed out by the sea. He's protected his property, but he's destroyed the beach for everybody that will ever go there in the future. And everywhere we go, we see the same story. And almost anything gets thrown down there to try and hold the sea in place. Old cattle grids, old bits of concrete piping. Here are some interesting gabion baskets with small stones put in to protect this footpath. How much easier would it have been to just move that footpath to the other side of the fence? But we don't think of those things. That would be adapting. This is resisting change. And in resisting that change, we're damaging the environment. We're stopping sediment arriving on the beach. We're causing waves to reflect off those gabion baskets and carry sediment away. And we're also creating an eyesore. You know, it's a pretty ugly scene whenever your shoreline is surrounded by concrete and bricks. Some more use of concrete. Notice in front of caravans, which after all are on wheels. So, you know, if your caravan's threatened, you can't move it. And sometimes there are ridiculous reasons for our armouring taking place. That little wall is serving absolutely no purpose. It's in front of a sand dune that had experienced a little bit of winter erosion. The local council had money left over at the end of the year, decided what should we do with it? Build a wall in front of that. And it seems ridiculous, but I'll bet that's a very common phenomenon all over Ireland. A little bit of money left over and we just patch up those dunes. Here's one in Northern Ireland in Clocky. It achieved some notoriety because the planning service regulations or policy says that they won't grant planning permission for anywhere threatened by coastal erosion. But they have, of course, the get-out clause of except under exceptional circumstances. This site didn't exist until the armour was put in, and then it was backfilled in order to create enough space to build a bungalow on top. And it was granted planning permission under these exceptional circumstances on the grounds that they needed more housing in Clocky. But they didn't need more housing right there. But it just underscores the lack of appreciation we have of our impacts at the shoreline. We think this is innocuous, harmless thing to do, and yet it is enormously damaging in many ways. That opens up a wider issue, which is that the practice of coastal engineering is destroying coastlines. Because anywhere someone experiences a problem, they get the phone book out, they phone up either their local council, whose engineer gets sent out, or they phone up a consulting engineer, and they'll come out and design a nice seawall or a structure to stop the erosion. But in doing that, they're destroying the ecosystems in front of them, they're degrading the environment, and they're encouraging more development by resisting the change that needs to take place. This engineering approach to coastal change is an impediment to coastal management, and it diverts attention from sea level rise. It creates the impression that we can deal with anything that comes along. We can put a wall in the way, we can save your garden, we can create a building site where none existed. And when you look at the major engineering works around the world, like the Dubai Palm Islands and so on, it's pretty clear you can do major bits of engineering, but how desirable it is another matter. I gave this talk to the Institute of Civil Engineers a couple of years back, so it was like being in the lion's den, but they took it in good humour, I'm glad to say. There are hundreds of buildings saved, thousands of people are happy as a consequence because it's their property and their investment, but it's a bankrupt profession because all it does is try to save the property. The problem is not the design and construction, they've got that nailed down very well. But the problem is the environmental impact of those structures and the lack of vision or appreciation of the future impacts of those structures on the shoreline, particularly at a time when global sea levels are rising and the shorelines are moving landwards. When we're putting barriers in the way and resisting that change, we're creating problems both for now and for the future. This used to be Waikiki Beach in Hawaii until it was engineered. The wall was put into to save the property behind the beach disappeared. The wall's now being undermined by the waves. The coral reef offshore has died. It's not exactly what you expect whenever you think of a Hawaiian beach. But there are impacts of these structures on the adjacent shorelines. The sand gets washed away. We find it difficult to get honest answers about how long nourished beaches might last. We find degradation by the structures themselves, and there are other options that aren't explored. Moving back, for example, is very seldom explored whenever we are faced with any challenge at the coastline. We're still into the resistance mode. And we argued to the coastal engineering folk that they find the truth according to the client's needs. They use a range of tools, a range of approaches that are infinitely adaptable to produce something that is just what you need. Incidentally, in the background, that is a beach in New Jersey. At least it used to be a beach in New Jersey. These are the holiday homes that were there. The beach was retreating. And a few decades worth of coastal engineering interventions transform the beach into something that looks like a scrapyard. when structures that have been put in don't work, there's always the excuse of storms. We didn't expect a storm of that size, or a storm from that direction, or a storm on that particular day. There's always a convenient excuse whenever the intervention doesn't work. We know that you can't predict beach behaviour at the accuracy at which they claim, but they never look back to test whether the models worked or not. They produce the simulations, say that we'll withstand a 1 in 10 year storm, or this beach will last for 10 years before we have to nourish it again. The beach is nourished, they're gone, and no one ever looks back. The big dilemma really is, should we really be engineering the coastline at all? A natural beach, a natural coast is a beautiful thing. It's not an engineering project. And yet many of them have been transformed into long, thin engineering projects. Practically the whole east coast of the United States is a long, thin engineering project with sand being pumped onto the beaches. Much of the Arabian Gulf is now an engineering project. Large sections of the French Riviera, the Spanish costas, and the Italian coast are engineering projects. But it's a worldwide plague. Even in remote parts of India, you notice the coastline there is lined with rock armour as far as the eye can see. This is a beach in Portugal. The trouble started out here with flooding, so a massive wall was built. The beach started to then disappear, so then groynes were built. After that, the sand was washed away down the sides of the groyne, so sand was pumped onto the beach. And once you create one problem, you come back and you get more money by solving that problem, but then you create more problems. It's like a license to print money once you start messing up the coastline. This one about takes the biscuit. This is a beach in South Wales. It was being eroded too frequently, so they tarmacked it. But to underscore the point that resistance is the only show in town, here's a map of Europe with armoured shorelines in 2001, so it's a dated map. But you can see that if you removed the yellow shading, you'd still see the outline of Europe pretty clearly. So there's a huge amount of the European coast that is engineered with solid structures. So clearly we are, as a society, resisting change. We're not adapting to it. Why do we do this? It's interesting to pose ourselves these questions, but I think there's a reluctance to change human activities. You know, there's an inbuilt conservatism that we've always done this here and we're always going to carry on doing this here. There's a desire to protect our current activities and our assets. We see that property and infrastructure as more valuable than the natural coastal environment. There's also some inherent desire for a once and for all solution. We want to build a wall, hold the shoreline in place and walk away and leave it. But as we see from the collapse of those seawalls that I showed you, that's not the case. Even when we do interfere or intervene, we still have to go and patch it up from time to time. There's a marked unwillingness to roll with the punches. We really, really don't like to have to adapt and clean up after a storm. But, you know, the storms that we had last winter are things that are occupational hazards of living at the coastline. Cleaning up after them and patching things up is one way that we can adapt and live with those changes. Money is an issue as well. It's cheaper in many cases, at least in the short term, to build a wall and think that's the problem solved than to start moving buildings, moving roads, moving infrastructure. But in the long term, perhaps that's a cheaper option. So just to finish up, it sounds bad enough, I think, that we're resisting change all the time. But I think it's even worse than that in some places because we are going backwards in a number of locations. These are a couple of photographs in the Outer Hebrides, where in the past people have farmed on the Macair here. They've rolled with the punches. When storms came in, the Macair would be covered in sand. It would move a little bit landwards, a bit like the Barrier Island in New Jersey, raise its level up a little bit. They'd go out the next year and sow their crops on top of it. Everything had just moved a little bit landward and they carried on with it. They had a big storm a few years back and the local council intervened. They got a big grant of money from the Scottish Government and they've armoured the shoreline now to stop it moving. That means that no fresh sand is coming into the Macair, which is the only cultivatable bit of land on the Outer Hebrides. So they're sowing the seeds of their own destruction by preventing the islands moving. They need to move in order to bring in the nutrients that allow traditional farming practice to take place. Further north in Iceland, here are two villages on the coast, small numbers of inhabitants. They've lived with sea floods for many years. And yet in the recent past, they've built dikes along the shoreline. Those dikes are pretty significant features on the landscape. This is not what you go to Iceland for. You go for wild, open landscapes, not rock armour and rubble and a built environment. But they've been put in to protect the properties in behind. Ironically, though, the people who lived there traditionally had lived upstairs. They had sacrificial basements. So everyone lived upstairs. They knew that flooding took place. They accepted it as a way of life. So they didn't put anything that would suffer from flooding down in the basement. Every house has steps going up to it. But since they put these defences in, everyone has now occupied their basement. They've turned it into a room for granny, or put an extra bedroom in for a B&B and so on. So they're moving in the opposite direction. These guys were adapted in the past to the environment, adapted to live with that environment. They now become resistant to the natural environment. This is maybe the most extreme instance of living on the edge. These are the Halligen in the German North Sea. When the tide's out, of course, this is salt marsh, it's grassy plains, but when you get an increased tide on the equinoxes or some particularly high spring tides, the individual dwellings are separated by water. But those are ancient types of dwellings. They have a well in the middle. They've got a ramp all around them. They're capable of surviving in there for a long period of time. They bring their animals in whenever the high tide is coming. And they've done that for centuries. They do that because their early efforts at resisting the sea failed in a big flood in 1634. If those hadn't failed, this would be like the Netherlands. They would still have, everything would be dry with canals everywhere and so on. They didn't patch that up, it was too big a job, and so consequently they've lived in harmony with that hostile environment. A lot of their past activities really had adapted to that. In this church, for example, there are no boards on the floor, there's sand there, and slots to allow water to flood out through it, because they know it gets flooded from time to time. That's one of those little houses that was surrounded by water in the other picture, but when the tide's down, it's surrounded by green grassy fields. They've messed this up now by building dikes around the sides of the whole island, so it doesn't allow those tides to come in. As a consequence, no fresh sediment is coming in and the islands are sinking. Sooner or later, they're going to have to raise the height of those dikes, and it's another instance of resisting change rather than adapting with it. So having sort of painted a gloomy picture of all the wrong things we're doing, what other options do we have, you might say? We can get out of the way. We can get out of the way passively by not letting buildings stand in the way of the changing coastline. You're not allowed to build hard structures on the coast of North Carolina. The beach must be allowed to move through. So consequently, although that house is gone, been condemned, surfers are still able to come down through the basement there, use the beach, and sooner or later this will be removed. Bad news for the owner, but they do that with their eyes open because they know they're not allowed to build hard defences. So if you've got $4 million to spare and you can afford to take that hit, you're welcome to do that. But the bottom line is that the beach mustn't be allowed to be damaged and you mustn't interfere with the natural coastal processes. Here's another thing. There's a school in Benbecula. It was affected during the same storm that I mentioned earlier in the Outer Hebrides. After that storm, they abandoned the school. Realise it's too hazardous location, and they've learned from their mistakes and moved out of the way. You can also move buildings physically, lock, stock and barrel, if they're important enough. Even with our construction styles, there's one being moved out of the way of the Channel Tunnel in England. In America it's easier because you just lift the house off the foundations and put it on a low loader. Not just houses, lighthouses, hotels. This one was moved in the 1800s to make way for the retreating beach. So we can move things out of the way. We can also try and prevent damage in these hostile environments by not building in vulnerable areas to start with, building specially adapted structures. There are even some structures being built now that can float on the tide. We can build things that can cope with the environment. This is adapting our building style, adapting the way we do things, and it's the type of thing that we need to do more of, I think. We also can improve our preparedness. We know we can't stop the change taking place, but we can prepare ourselves for the impacts of those changes. So educating people about the changes that are taking place, letting people make informed decisions about what they do at the coast, where they invest their money, and what activities they partake in, whether they drive their bus along the beach and whenever the tide's coming in and the storm's on the back of it, for example. There are also instruments we can use to encourage people to get out of the way. In New Jersey, after Hurricane Sandy, they instigated a buyout program to try and encourage some people to to leave and to reduce the risk to the communities there. In other states in the US, Maine, Texas, South Carolina, and Rhode Island, they have a program of rolling easements, which means that if your property's damaged up to a certain percentage, you're not allowed to rebuild it after that. If it's damaged up to, say, 60%, you're allowed to rebuild. If it's damaged more than 60%, you must take it down and not rebuild on the same site. It allows people to make that informed decision about whether it's worth their while to continue to reoccupy the site. So rolling with the punches means reducing the risk by good planning. It means getting things out of the way by active or passive retreat. It means changing how we do things and living with that risk. In some cases, we've done that in the past and we haven't done it recently. It also means informing the public, highlighting the risk, and giving us the information we need to make the right decisions. Emergency planning, knowing that risk will transform itself into hazard from time to time, and even post-event measures, planning for the inevitable disasters that will take place and having recovery programs for those. These are the types of things that are envisaged in rolling with the punches, or true adaptation. They're quite different from the idea of resisting. We can also learn from past experience. There's enough accumulated knowledge of what happens at the coastline under different circumstances for us to know what happens. And we can pick our fights. We might not be able to roll with the punches everywhere. I mean, cities are going to have to be defended, but small lines of houses teetering on the edge of a cliff don't have to be defended, and they shouldn't be defended. So we have to be strategic in how we deal with climate change and the threats that it poses to us at the coast. So we have a fight on our hands. It's like a boxing match. We have to learn to adapt our activities rather than stubbornly try to maintain them. If you'd like to find out anything more about this, you can see it in my book entitled The Last Beach. It's available on Amazon and in a number of bookshops.